The following is an at-will presentation.
Welcome to The Marrow, conversations with creatives about who they are and why they make what they make. I'm your host, Josh Reebok. Today, I am talking with Justin Kuchara, visual director for fashion designers. He has also constructed sets on Broadway. Justin provides for us a visual and immersive experience. Justin Kuchara, my wonderful, wonderful friend. Thank you so much for being here.
Of course.
Describe to me your job. I think you have one of the most fascinating jobs in the world. Even if you don't, I do. And I'm such an admirer of your work. Every time I get to see it, it inspires me. So describe your work, Justin.
Well, I work for a company, Billy Reed. He's a luxury fashion designer. And what I do for him is I help him take his interior design visions from zero to a full-on store. Revisions of spaces, creating these environments, environments that include everything from like what types of candles we burn on a daily basis to, you know, the type of light fixture that we're putting into the ceiling, the types of flooring that we're putting in. And really what I do is as I guide the process, and we love to create these environments where people feel welcome, mm-hmm. where people come in and spend hours and like really feel like it's their own home in a way. We want our stores to feel very residential and like comforting. So yeah, I mean, that's primarily what I do. I to create these just homes, these shoppable environments.
And for me, I've gotten to go and be present in a lot of these spaces that you've made, whether that's Florence or Austin or Nashville or multiple stores in New York City, Chicago. I mean, really all up and down the eastern half of the United States. And one thing that I'm always so, I guess, mesmerized by is if ever you're in one of these places, the portraits and the mirrors, I mean, it looks like you have rummaged through the antique store of time to, like, collect these things. There's a painting in the West, I want to say it's the West Village Billy Reed store in New York City.
Okay.
And it's above the stair, or it's above one of the staircases, and it's like this woman, and correct me if I'm wrong, it certainly wouldn't be the first time, but it almost looks like a Day of the Dead painting where it's like this really opulent, like oil painting of this woman looking Victorian era, high collar feather coming out of this really fancy hat. But then it looks like someone has painted a skeleton over her. And the first time I saw that, like, you know, my wonderful wife was in the store.
Right.
And I think it was one of those moments where she had to come up to me and go, "I've been calling you for the last 5 minutes." Because I was so captivated by the painting. I mean, like where do you find this stuff, and how in your head do you go, this is what is going to make this place feel the way people need to feel?
Well, a lot of what I actually put into these stores are, like, in terms of artwork and decor, well, specifically artwork, these are Billy's friends. Like that one painting you just referenced, that's Butch Anthony.
Wow.
And he is a Florence, Alabama native, friend of Billy's. His wife, Natalie Channon, and Billy have like a really great working relationship. She provides Billy with organic cotton farmed down in Alabama. And they just have this wonderful relationship. And Butch loves putting his artwork in our shops. Now, that store in particular, I mean, that hallway that you're referencing is a really boring hallway. It's like this little 5x7 piece of store real estate that leads into our stock room. So when I saw this wall, I was like, what am I going to put on this wall? Like, what am I going to put in this hallway? This thing is so boring. Like, we have one light fixture. We have a coat rack. I was like, I need something, like, captivated. Yeah, I'm glad you said that because we needed something. So when I was thinking about like what I can do, it's kind of this tucked away little hallway. I needed a pop. I needed something that would just like be completely different from the rest of the space.
Yeah.
And that's when I called upon Butch. I was like, Butch, what do you have? What can we use? And we had this gigantic red painting. And it is. It's like oddly weird but beautiful and captivating. And I needed to put it in there. Like I needed that juxtaposition of something completely opposite of the rest of the space to make that hallway interesting.
I mean, if you're in one of these places, it's like you'll see a giant, you know, 10-foot mirror with like this ornate limestone frame, and then there will be this like psychedelic profile of a horse head beside a guy who looks like he's out of the Civil War holding a little baby with a pinned old school diaper. It's so eclectic, and yet it feels like there's this like completely understandable and comforting kind of cohesion. And I don't know. I mean, I think that has
a lot to do with where we're pulling our artwork and where we're pulling our artifacts from. I mean, it's I'm really calling upon Billy's closest neighbors and friends and loved ones, and I think it all just kind of plays into the overall aesthetic.
Yeah,
you know, like this like tangible communal thing.
Yeah.
That happens.
There's definitely an identity. Yeah. You know, like I've gotten to meet, I mean, I've had the privilege of meeting Billy multiple times, but it's such a marvel to me that you can tangibly and in a material way create an extension of his identity. And not that, you know, you're going to fully represent that, but to me there is, you get this glimpse of the person who is making these clothes, which then you want to associate yourself with and that you feel good in by simply stepping into that space. But here's my question. Like, when did you get into this? Like, when did Justin first feel this inclination towards visual design?
Well, it's actually, man, it's a hell of a story, actually. You know, when you're in high school, you don't know who you are. You don't know what you're doing. Like, I barely knew my left foot from my right foot. You know what I mean? Like, I had no idea.
Right.
You're supposed to pick a major. I knew I wanted to do something in arts. Like, my older brother was a huge inspiration on me. He was an artist, sculptor, all that. And I knew I wanted to do something. What that specific thing was, I had no idea. Right. So fast forward to, like, time to pick your major, time to pick college.
Right.
I was like, I can't do it. I just can't do it. So I went to community college for 2 years, completely lost. No idea. Took education, took psychology, took 2D design, took drawing classes just to keep my mind active, right? I knew I needed to do that at least. I put together some sort of like makeshift portfolio. I went up to Penn State University, and I didn't expect, you know, like to do anything, see anyone, interview with anybody. I went up there actually with my mom, and her sister had an education conference. We went up just to see the campus. My mom calls the dean, well, she calls the art department, the dean of the arts and architecture program, who I didn't know was the dean at the time, offered to sit down with me. We sat in a sculpture garden. Didn't even have my portfolio, didn't have a resume, didn't have my GPA. Like, nothing was on my mind at that point. We sat down in a sculpture garden, and we started talking about this piece of sculpture. Like, the movement, the energy, like, how, you know, what it meant, you know, why it was in that specific spot of the garden. And she goes, you know what? She goes, I think you need to be in theater.
She pulled that blind just out of a conversation.
Yeah, out of nowhere. You need to be in theater. Okay. I do. She goes, yeah, I want to see you here in August. I need you to be in theater. You are accepted to this school.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, sure.
I mean, when she said that, were you invigorated? I mean, were you inspired?
I'm actually getting chills. I'm getting chills thinking about it. Because at that moment, somebody gave me direction. Because I didn't know what I wanted to, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. So that person, Joyce Buck, she goes, you need to be in theater.
Wow.
You can pick up your acceptance letter tomorrow morning. was like, what?
Amazing.
Right? So at that point, I had a direction. So from then on, I was just studied theater and creating environments and, you know, how the environment you're in affects a person or can tell a story or can, you know, portray emotions, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I not stumbled upon it, but that's how I was tossed into it.
That had to have been, I don't know. I mean, that had to have been such a meaningful moment. I mean, if I, you know, translate that moment into my life at all, and the people who have maybe in some moment in time affirmed, one, that I'm maybe good at something, and two, that maybe there is a legitimate path for me to do that thing over the course of a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Like, those are some of the people that, I mean, I don't, they have. They've changed my life, whether that's over an entire decade or in a moment. I mean, for me, and we've talked about this a little before, I like, that is such, you know, a difficult thing for me to hold on to on a daily basis, that I have some sense of, like, I don't know, functionality in the world. I mean, you know, what's the old poem, you know, like this idea that the world is a chorus and that you can play a part.
Yeah.
That idea that I can play a part and that it matters is for me so difficult to hang on to sometimes. And that's, you know, out of my own insecurity, and that's my own self-doubt and my own self-hatred. But when people give that to me, it's a bigger gift than I ever even know how to thank them for.
Yeah. Yeah. She definitely sparked a sense in me of just, like, you know, you're a storyteller, you know, and that's the one thing that I'd learned about myself over the course of time through the theater, even through what I do with Billy and creating our spaces. You're a storyteller, you know, and that's kind of one thing that I have kind of hung on to throughout and would like to just continue to push forward.
Yeah.
And it's not even necessarily my story. It's, I love telling other people's stories.
Hmm.
You know, I love telling Billy's story.
Hmm.
It's great. It's authentic.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to ask, like, what do you think it is about the Billy Reed story that, I mean, what is it about that resonates with you?
I think it's a authentic, genuine aspect about Billy the man, who he is very in tune with his family and his priorities, but yet he is making, you know, a splash in the New York City fashion world, you know, the US fashion world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think him holding on to his ties to family and ties to the South, really, where he grew up, and his ties to his mother, who owned a boutique. You know, that's how he got into it. And his just kind of personal story and personal life is something that I just really kind of, it resonates within me.
Yeah.
I guess because I'm a family person myself.
Yeah.
You know, like, my family is very important to me.
Yeah.
And the fact that his family is very important to him, yet he's still creating these, like, amazing lines of clothing and these awesome, you know, these awesome stores and these awesome events that he's doing.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
You mentioned the concept of family. So you're sitting in a garden, and, you know, when I think about my parents' ambitions for me, and my parents, you know, my parents have been dead almost 10 years now, but they were in different moments. It took time for them to come around to the way that I saw my gifts providing a living for me. So you're sitting in a garden, and, you know, this dean phantoms out of nowhere and tells you you should be a, you know, go into sculpting and you should be in theater and, you know, on and on. Was your family immediately supportive and on board with this?
100%. It was wild.
Hmm.
I remember I left that interview with Joyce Buck, and I immediately found my mom, who was walking around campus, and I was like, "Mom, I'm going to Penn State." She goes, "I knew it. I knew something was coming up with this." She goes, "It's God's work. I love it. It's like, now we got to find you a house. Like, when can we pick up the acceptance letter? Wow. So, like, we kind of didn't believe it. It was still a little bit surreal.
Yeah.
Like, the rest of that day, we were, like, trying to figure out how I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
How I'm going to get up to Penn State. But then, you know, after calling friends and family, whatever, everyone was so supportive. Not once was the economics of it discussed.
Hmm.
Like, we'd all work it out somehow.
What was the first show you worked on? Can you go back? Can you go back that far and recall?
Yeah. So, I mean, there was definitely some like theoretical projects that we worked on, but the mm-hmm. first one that I took from initial concept and script to a final product with audience was actually Penn State's children's show, and it was A Year with Frog and Toad. You remember your Frog and Toad, the books?
I remember Wind in the Willows. Is that Frog and Toad or no?
Maybe. I don't know.
Well, anyway, tell us about Frog and Toad.
A Year of Frog and Toad. Right. It's so ridiculous. A Year of Frog and Toad. Well, no, it's funny because this is when I learned the power of theater. A Year of Frog and Toad. I took the project on. I was like, man, what is this? I'm designing a children's show. Like, I don't want to design a children's show.
Right.
And all my professors were like, just trust us, do this. So I took this design, and I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go for it. All in. I'm putting everything I got into this children's show. So I did it, and we get through the entire process. And what's striking about this was day one, it opens. The children walk into the theater, and there's this massive theater at the Penn State Playhouse, and it was just loads and hordes of children yelling, like, rah, 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 just crazy yelling. The decibel levels in that place were high, right? Teachers were yelling, shh, shh, shh. The minute the house lights went down, those children just, nothing. They were so in tune with what was going on stage, and there was not one peep in that theater until the show ended. They were all leaving, and then every child was like, I want to be Frog. I want to be Toad. I like this. But, like, what we did was we never once thought, you know, this is a children's show. We should dumb it down. We kept it sophisticated enough that, you know, there was some adult concepts through, and those children absolutely loved it. I was like, man, this art form's powerful.
Yeah.
You know, this storytelling can be very powerful.
Yeah, absolutely.
If children are getting it, if children are loving it, how can I translate that into the adult art form?
Man, if I were to sit here and go, when are some of the moments when exposed to something visual, whether that be a painting or theater or a movie, that I've, like, cried and been moved on a really deep level? I mean, there'd be a host of moments. I mean, I'm a crier, so that's what I do in some ways. But a number of those moments would be when, in theory, it's a quote children's story. Like when I saw the film Inside Out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it breaks me, not in just a way of sorrow, but it's like this kind of three-dimensional emotional experience. I mean, literally in that one. But that notion that like, even if it's a, quote, children's story, if told without dumbing it down and trusting that a kid not only can be, but in some sense wants to be moved and inspired just like we do as adults, it can be really, really marvelous and certainly meaningful. But was that, like, the most – in that moment and in the subsequent years, is that typically when you find the most satisfaction in your work, when you see other people – kind of colliding with it and finding meaning in it?
Hands down. I mean, that's why I do it.
Hmm.
You know, it's the minute that some person or, you know, somebody interacts with a space that I've created, it justifies all of the troubles of the previous weeks, months, years that it took to get to that point.
Hmm.
You know, and sometimes it's a negative reaction, and that's where you grow. You know, you hear that, you take the criticism, and you go.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's astonishing what people kind of see that you don't.
Yeah.
You know, when you're in a project so much, and you've created something, they, you know, they're picking something out of the out of the project that they love, that is their favorite, that you wouldn't necessarily think like, oh man, like that was the one thing. I'm glad they got that.
Yeah, right.
Kind of like this Butch Anthony, you know, the Butch Anthony. Yeah, painting, you know,
right.
Like
yeah, right.
The fact that you love that so much is great for me. Like I love hearing that because I didn't intend to. I just needed to make that hallway interesting.
Yeah. How do you deal with you mentioned it, the criticism? Do you take criticism hard?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's you have to have it. I feel like kind of going all the way back to even high school now, I took AP art, and the one thing that my professor teacher told us was you need to learn to take criticism. And we would sit around in a circle and just like we would criticize everyone's piece of artwork. And you just have to learn to take it. Just take it and just take what you need out of it.
Yeah.
And move on.
Are you able to filter through, hey, I think this is legitimate and this is more subjective and I just don't agree?
Yeah.
Oh.
No, you have to. You have to be that way.
Dude,
right? Or else you'll just like, I'll just curl up in a ball and...
Well, now you're talking about me on Thursdays.
Like you have to.
I mean, dude, like you're absolutely right in the sense that it's not plausible to make anything or breathe. If you are breathing, you are going to be criticized. Even if you're not breathing.
Right.
I mean, history says you're going to be criticized. It depends on the day. On the days when I feel stable, I'm able to receive it. Evaluate not only what they're criticizing, but the source of the criticism, and determine what's legitimate, determine what I can learn from and what is just really toxic. But I have, you know, I mean, I don't know what the breakdown would be, but I feel like I have an even ratio of stable days to unstable days where I take that criticism and I kind of throw it on my back and then run down the staircase of my own soul and I take it all the way down to a place where that criticism determines my value and determines my identity. And I go to this place of going, they think I'm this, therefore I am that. And, you know, one day, I cannot wait till I have the day where I do not empower other people with my, like, sense of value.
Yeah.
And that's where I get into so much trouble when it comes to criticism is I make that voice gospel on me. And so, you know, like I said, it depends on the day, but I absolutely have that that curl up under the bed sheets moment where I can't stand, you know, to look in any face other than that of my dog and just go, he doesn't care. he doesn't care if, you know, I forgot the relation between subject and object in my writing today, or if he thinks I'm a wizard with words, or if he thinks I'm handsome. He doesn't care, and that makes this the safest place in the world right now.
My outlet for that is actually cooking. I think.
I love your foods. That's good.
I think. I mean, because like that's the one thing where. It's the one thing I can do right now that. I just do like kind of for my, you know, I do it for myself. You know. Just let it go. I start cooking and like stress just starts to evaporate and like the daily grind just evaporates.
Yeah.
You're just kind of in it. You're on autopilot and you're doing it.
Yeah.
Sauteing this, frying that, whatever.
You do it like purely for joy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you're the oasis, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, it's like really, I'm really into it. Oh, so much so we're just like, man, maybe I should follow that because that makes me feel really great.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, right.
Like don't get me wrong. I love building environments and building stores and renovating places. But man, should I be cooking?
if only it could remain that pure.
I know.
And that it wouldn't then invite in the same things that are the very reasons we sometimes want to ditch the other things we're doing. Like I told Kristen, I think it was like last week, I was like, you know, I've been thinking lately, and you know, immediately she's like, oh God. You know, she's like, now what? And I
what
like,
we get into?
I was like, I think maybe I should be a garbage man. And she's like, you don't want to be a garbage man. I'm like, I don't know. I'm like, I don't know. And so then I make my somewhat farcical pitch. But I know that the reason in my mind any other vocation is more appealing, it's simply because I don't know what it's like to be in those vocations and experience criticism and the feelings that I do in my own.
Right.
And the truth is, like, no job, you know, at least, I mean, I'm 37, no job or relationship that I've ever had has insulated me from these things that are within me. Like, I carry them into all these things. And so as soon as I do, then I just want to, it's not the job I want to get out of. It's the feelings that I experience in my own body and mind every single day. And sadly, I don't think you can major in that. I want to major in no self-doubt.
Yeah, right.
What inspires you, Justin?
Experiences. It's doing things. It's people, you know, interactions.
What's one of the more inspiring moments or conversations or places you've stood in over the last number of years? Because you require... I mean, to me, like, to do the kind of work you do, or even, you know, any of the people that, you know, we get to, you know, are privileged enough to have on this show, for all these people that are so inspiring, they have to really feast on their own inspiration in order to create, right? So what's, like, a moment you've had that's done that for you?
It's hard to pinpoint that. Mm. It really is, but, I mean, I can say that take New Orleans, for example. When we were building in New Orleans, this 1920 shotgun house, at first, I wasn't quite into it because I was dealing with, you know, realtors, you know, and the whole lease process and architects and contractors. You know, you were just dealing with this, like, very, I guess, analytical. What's the word I'm looking for?
You're on the logistical administrative side.
Exactly. Yeah, I was rocking left brain pretty hard. And it wasn't until the project became mine that I started to design in the space. And at this time, I was living in New Orleans for about a few weeks now, and I was starting to get to know my neighbors, and I was getting to know the people down the street, and Youngblood. I met Youngblood down the street, and he'd been living on that street for, I don't know, all of his life, 50-some years. This is an old guy who walks up the street every day. And I was like, hey, man, how are you? He's like, yeah, I'm Youngblood. If you ever need anything, you let me know. Like, those types of interactions kind of molded my idea of what this space could become.
Hmm.
On the block itself, there's, like, these small boutique retailers that we're kind of, like, we would almost be competitive with, but you know, once you got to know them, you knew this was going to be a great partnership. And it was those types of kind of relationships that helped me sculpt this environment. And you can see it now, looking back on it, we tore every wall down in that space. So it was a shotgun, 1920 shotgun, is two apartments side by side, longer than they are short, with a separating wall.
Okay.
And we tore that wall down. You know, we took this space, we opened it up, open floor plan, and then we built a kitchen. We built a working kitchen in this space. And we built an outside area with a patio that has a wet bar and a grill and a TV to watch the Saints games. You know, and things like that just kind of influenced this space to become what it is now. And like that to me is inspiring, is the community and their influence on you as a designer creating these spaces.
I hear I hear you know, actresses talk about a form of what I at least the way you describe it, I hear something similar where they're looking to get to this kind of place of truth. And for you, it's like getting what is the to that place of truth about New Orleans, and not just trying to sit there in a blank room and go, oh, well, what's New Orleans like? But to, like, collide with these very kind of raw, spontaneous, whether it's gritty or glamorous, but these moments that are kind of mirrors of what that place feels like, and then get to create something that represents that for people. I mean, I get why that would be inspiring. And I'm such a visual person. Like, for me, the most inspiring things tend to be the things I can see, a painting or the kind of space you're talking about. I mean, Kristen and I went to the Met Museum on Monday. And for me, I mean, that is just this, like, endless banquet of inspiration. And I just want to gorge for hours, because whether it's this, like, tiny little Egyptian coin, you know, that was excavated, you know, in the Gaza Strip or whatever, and to see not only the way it's eroded, but the images and what all that iconography represents, but then to go into another exhibit that's modern couture fashion, contrasting what's made by machine and what's made by hand, and I see those things. When I'm in there, I feel like I am given permission to then go and make something. I'm like, there's this one dress that's in the Met Museum right now, and, you know, it almost looks like a wedding dress, like that elegant, kind of this cream white from head to toe, but they sewed on these fabric blossoms from the bottom hem to the top of the neck. But as the blossoms move north, they go from fully bloom blossoms to at the very top around this high neck, it's just the buds.
Oh, that's cool.
So it's like you're seeing this mass bloom on the way down. And as they talk about, they said they had to sew on, I think there's over 700 of them. They talk about the man hours. And I sit there and I go, wow. Like, it's not just inspiring me creatively, but even the meticulous method inspires me and gives me permission to be meticulous and to take time and not to rush. And so those are the things that I leave. I think one of the greatest compliments one can give another creative, and I could certainly pay this to you and certainly to a lot of these designers at whose work is on display at the Met now, but to me, one of the greatest compliments to give a creative is, your creativity makes me want to create. You making something makes, and me being exposed to it makes me want to go make things. And that's like, I mean, hopefully that's part of the motivation for all of us. It's like you want to inspire people to go and whatever their crazy mind and experiences have led them to make things that are an extension of that. In the theater world, you know, in the design world that you're a part of, I mean, certainly does that for me. So I want to ask you about something. So you make things that are so tangible, like you can touch them. So there is this Eastern world practice called the mandala.
Okay.
And the mandala is where monks will go out into the desert and they will spend days, weeks, upwards sometimes to months creating these sand sculptures, intricate line work. And it's all on like the floor of the desert. It's all in sand. And it's typically they're four-sided, they're circles. I mean, it almost looks like a piece of like Baroque art, you know, it's like that complex.
Sure.
And they get to the end, and let's say it's a three-month project, you know, 10, 12 hours a day for 3 months, they get to the end and then they wipe it all away.
I love that.
They just wipe it all away. They wipe the whole thing off. And sometimes they'll actually jar, they'll jar and lid all the sand they use. Then they carry it to a river and they dump it in the river. And then this creation that now exists in their minds but nowhere else gets kind of distributed back out into the world. But I guess my question is, I mean, all the things that you build will probably at some point be unbuilt.
Sure.
The construction will probably at some point lead to deconstruction. Do you have a hard time letting go of these things that you make?
No, not at all.
Really?
Yeah, not at all, actually.
Oh my gosh.
The thing, I mean, for me, like, I think the process is just as important as the final product. You know, like, the viewer viewing it, the person who walks through the doors or sits in the audience, like that to me is number one. It's why I do it, you know? But I think the process of it is really kind of the jumping board for myself in terms of, okay, you know, looking back on it and my own personal criticism is like, all right, so this was the process that it took. You know, what can I pull from that? What can I keep? What should I throw away? You know, what did I learn? That I think is wildly just as important as that final view for me. Things aren't forever.
Yeah,
that's right. That's the nature of us. Things aren't forever. So, yeah, let's do something together. Let's create something together. Let's collaborate. Let's create this environment. Let's show it off. And then let's do something else. Let's do it again. Let's wipe it out.
Yeah.
Let's do it again. So well, I love that.
Well, and that's so much the, I mean, you know, that's so much the mentality of that sand mandala exercise. Is it's not only to recognize the ephemeral and fleeting nature of life, but it's to celebrate it and to embrace it, and then to also go, hey, now this sand is blank again.
Yeah.
Now we can make something else right here. Rather than kind of like, I don't know, always looking back, but to go, now there's new potential in this space. That's, I don't know.
And then the next time, maybe it's greater.
I was you thinking know? About this, though, and I was talking to Kristen, and I said, Kristen, if I work for 3 months on a short story or a collection, imagine getting to the end of 3 months, 10 hours, and then just hitting delete. And not, there's no backup. I haven't sent it to anyone. It's just gone, and the only place it now remains is in the minds and hearts of those who have already experienced it. And then maybe those who can, you know, through oral tradition, pass it on. But otherwise, it's gone. And I thought, I have never tried to put that into practice. But the concept, I'm not sure I have the fortitude to pull that off. I mean, I'm sure I have some kind of idolatry with my own work that I, you know, need its company somehow. But that's, to me, that's an amazing, and it's an amazing thing that you can do that.
I mean, it's kind of part of my training in theater too. You know, that plays into that, because you know a lot of what you do is like, you work to create something. It's up for a limited amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's down. And then let's get the same team back together. Let's tell a different story.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the times have changed. So there's another story more important for us to tell right now than what was that.
David Foster Wallace, you know, he wrote Infinite Jest and a number of other things. When Infinite Jest was being edited, he had all these large portions that were being edited out. I mean, I think it's still with the endnotes like 1,300 pages or something, but there's all these portions. And he, though he fought, you know, to keep some of them in, he did say, if we're going to take them out, I have to delete them from my computer. Like, I can't even know that they're around anymore, or I'll be too tempted to try to implement
them
back into the body, you know, into the massive body of this text. And that, I don't know, there's something great about that. It's the whole, like, kill your darlings, you know, concept. It's like, let go. And I don't know, man. I haven't been trained in that the way you have.
I mean, that's the nature of it though, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, especially specifically with telling stories, people change, you know, the times change.
Where do you feel like storytelling is going?
I don't know.
Other than it's like, old political figures rapping, obviously.
It's like, I think it's going more intense, more. This whole virtual reality thing is really bugging me out. I think storytelling is gonna have to kind of go into this like digital world. I don't know. Maybe it's a little bit of a stretch, but I just feel like people are not experiencing as much as they should be. Everyone's kind of tuned into their TV or their, you know, their iPad, iPod. And we're lacking this kind of tangible experience.
Yeah.
You know?
Which is part of what makes the theater, for me, really powerful. Like, Kristen and I saw a show in autumn of 2014, I think, called The Fortress of Solitude. And, you know, we were just a few rows from the front in a pretty tiny theater. So we're like near the front, and this actor is just a few feet away. I mean, you can see the sweat, but he, in this really powerful kind of soliloquy, is crying. And what was so powerful for me about that is to go, acting or not, he's really crying right now. Like, I'm seeing another human being emote in front of, you know, whatever, a couple hundred people.
Right.
And for me, in the increasingly kind of what feels like at times a one-dimensional storytelling experience,
right,
it makes it so visceral. Like in a good way, it sometimes makes me uncomfortable in a way, but like my TV screen insulates me from of that,
right,
from some of that kind of awkwardness per se. But in the theater environment, it's like, this is a human being and they're actually crying, they're actually screaming, they're actually singing a flat note or whatever. And so there's an intimacy that it creates that I think does get lost sometimes.
I mean, I think that's kind of what we're starting to miss, like in a really broad sense in humanity right now, is those, like, those quirks, those little nuances of people that we miss now because we are so, like, boxed off or guarded or, you know, we're, at least that's what I'm seeing. That's the general trend right now. That bothers me. You know?
Yeah. Do you get lonely?
No, I don't get lonely because I have a really great support system with family. I have two brothers here in the city. You know, I have my girlfriend of 9 years right by my side. I have family right in Philadelphia that's easily accessible. You know, so if I ever do feel that, I can nip that in the butt. Pretty quick.
What breaks your heart, Justin?
World troubles, man. Really, it's like politics and war. There's like overarching concepts of humanity right now. It kills me. Gets me fired up. The fact that people are like suffering. I can't stand knowing that people are suffering. That hurts, you know?
Yeah. You have such an empathetic heart, too. I mean, even the, you know, the converse of the way it breaks your heart, it's interesting because what breaks your heart is people suffering. Your favorite part of your work is people finding meaning, you know? I mean, that's kind of like two sides of the same coin. I sometimes have to... Yeah, I have to remember to not engage too much of the, you know, the news, the, you know, proverbial news feed, because sometimes I do find it discouraging.
Yeah.
You know, I do find it discouraging, and I think for me at times it can start to, I don't know, warp my concept of that there is good and that there's suffering, but then there's a lot of wonderful people, amazing people, you know, a lot of reasons to smile.
I mean, there's really like, I think it's kind of why I love food so much, you know, it brings people together, it brings people happiness. And then it's why I like creating spaces, you know, it's a communal aspect, like getting a group of people under the same roof is awesome.
Yeah.
I love that. And then there's times where I'm like, well, what am I doing? Like, why am I creating spaces for people who have spaces? Like, why aren't I working for a Habitat for Humanity and building homes for people who need it? You know, there's always that.
How do you answer that?
I look occasionally for you know, job postings, like, all right, how am I going to do this? How am I going to get a philanthropic aspect to my, you know, to my being? How am I going to do this? I think that's kind of my next hurdle, my next move in a way. It's to be able to help people.
Yeah. Sometimes it does feel like, for me, sitting down and it's like writing, I go, is there a more fulfilling way, not only for me to exist, but to, you know, contribute in the existence of others? And on the one hand, I think, yeah, I mean, of course, I don't know if any of us have hit the zenith of meaning or something like that. Right. But at the same time, like, you know, I think there's also something. I do think it is perhaps at times like chasing a unicorn.
Yeah.
And that for me, it's like, I do think I chase just I don't know if, I mean, maybe more is the word, but there's just a, there's an ache or an emptiness. And I want to feel, I want that to be eradicated in me. And there is something in me that wants to contribute to eradicating and abolishing that in other people. But I don't know if the, I don't know. I don't trust myself enough to leap from thing to thing thinking I'm not that altruistic enough. I know at the end of the day I'm doing it for me somehow. You know?
That's like a, I mean, that's my internal struggle, man. It's like, it's not about me, it's not about you, it's about it's about us.
Mm-hmm. We should go ahead, sorry.
No, I was gonna say that's my struggle.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of the times.
Hmm. Do you feel guilt?
No. I mean, no. I don't like live a life of luxury, but you know.
Mm-hmm.
I try not to own a lot of things.
Yeah.
You know, I have a few possessions. I can live pretty small. I like it that way. I joke with Rachel a lot that if we'd ever move out of the city, I would love to own like a little shack in Connecticut and like manage a small hardware store.
Yes.
And like make myself a boat. Go like, fishing.
Like a rowboat though.
Yeah. I mean, I have to start somewhere. I've never made a boat before. I can build a house. I've never made a boat.
Right.
But like a little rowboat.
Yeah.
Go fish at night. Come back, cook that fish. For the family.
Simple, right?
Simple.
Yeah.
Have a little garden.
You would have people over all the time.
I would love that.
Every day.
I would love that.
Yeah. In your shack. In your boat.
I'd hope you come up. It'd be great. But yeah, just like that sense of just like stripping it down. I like that. I like that idea.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why at some point I want to collaborate with you on something.
Let's do it.
You bring your T square and your I don't even know the tools. You bring bring your mind, and I'll bring the shrapnel left of mine. And with words and with all that you do, it would be really, really. I don't even know what it would be.
We'd figure it out.
So maybe I'll make you figure it out.
Great, thanks.
No, that would be amazing. I would love that.
You just need a pencil and a paper.
Pencil and a paper. That's all we need. Dude, thank you so much for doing this.
Of course.
Justin Kuchar, you are the man, and grateful for your time.
Thank you.
In a world teetering on the brink of collapse, two friends must learn a secret.
If we don't do it, no one will.
You're right. We can't let anyone or anything stop us now.
A secret that stands between order and chaos.
Ben, you've got to get the secret. Save the world.
I can't do it alone. Come with me, Dahlia.
A secret that only these two mighty podcasters could unlock.
How will we know when we have the right one?
I don't know. I think maybe we'll just get a funny feeling. Maybe this is it.
No one in my family has ever been in any kind of relationship like this.
No! Try again!
Could it be this one?
He had gone into the room where she had kept all of her clothes and set them on fire.
No!
But can they do it in time?
OMG, Ben. I want to go home.
You try one, Dahlia.
We're going to be here all night.
Wait. Here, one more.
The nexus of the plan was us having a really a good relationship with crackhead Johnny.
Ben Hamm and Dahlia Beta save the world in Season 2 of The Secret Room.
Season 2 premieres September 19th, coming to a podcast app near you.
Pod On.